Turn to Matthew chapter 24. Want to continue our study of Matthew 24. If you remember, Matthew 24 obviously comes on the heels of Matthew 23. Matthew 23, Jesus says some of the most toughest language in the New Testament as he excoriates the scribes and the Pharisees, the religious elite, for their hypocrisy and so forth, criticizes the Jewish nation. Then he pronounces a death sentence on the nation at the end of the chapter. They had been guilty of killing the prophets. And he says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem," verse 37, "the one who kills the prophets and stones those who were sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing." Now here's the death sentence. "See, your house is left unto you desolate." He really shook up the disciples. In the next chapter, they take him aside and they're showing him all of the wonderful buildings of the temple complex. And remember, we showed some pictures of those things, and it was a magnificent edifice. And they ask him, when, verse 3, tell him these things will be, and what would be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age, or the end of the world. In their minds, if this was going to be destroyed and not one stone left upon another, it was the end of the world. We've already studied a good portion of the chapter, and very importantly, the event that Jesus is describing was predictable. There were some definite signs that would take place. So he is not talking about the end of the world, the final judgment that we read about, for example, in 2 Peter chapter 3. The day and the hour of that no man knows, neither the angels in heaven or not even the Son himself, but only the Father. So let's pick up then in, make sure I hit the right button here, or I'll be in trouble. In verses 23 to 26, Jesus is telling his disciples for a second time to beware of imposters. Excuse me. Things work better when you turn them on. He says in verse 23, "Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There,' do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders, so as to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the desert,' do not go out. Or, 'Look, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it." The world has always been plagued with false teachers, false prophets, deceivers, however you want to term it, since the very beginning. God gave Adam and Eve a very simple law. Don't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. In the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die. And what did the devil say? He added a word: you will not surely die. We see the false prophets, for example, in Pharaoh's magicians. They were able to duplicate the early signs that Moses did insofar as turning water to blood and the frogs, but they couldn't create lice from dust, and they admitted then it was the finger of God that was doing these things. We can look at Nebuchadnezzar's magicians and astrologers and sorcerers in Daniel 2. They were giving Nebuchadnezzar the wrong information, but Nebuchadnezzar was a little smarter than them because he not only wanted the interpretation of the dream, he wanted to know the dream itself. And then we have so many examples in the New Testament. And we talked about that at length in our Bible class this morning. And Simon the sorcerer in Acts 8 would be a good example. But there's a big difference between false teaching and the truth. In 1 John 4, John tells us to test the spirits, whether they are of God. For how many false prophets have gone out into the world? Many false prophets. And he gives us the test in verse 6. Does their word that they're speaking agree with the word of the inspired apostles? And of course, the inspired apostles were guided into all truth, John 6:14, 15, and 16. In Galatians 1, verses 6 to 9, we studied this morning, we have to be careful that we don't get carried away with another gospel, a different gospel than that which is preached on the pages of God's book. There's also a big difference between false miracles and true miracles. I remember one of the faith healers. I can't remember which one it was. I think it might have been Benny Hinn, if you've ever seen him. He's quite a flashy character. Well, one time he went to Thailand and with his medicine show, you might say, and I have to give the people in Thailand credit. The government threw him out of the country because they recognized that he was a fake and a phony. True miracles are found in the pages, again, of God's book, and they're always with a purpose in mind, to confirm the word of the speakers. It wasn't to put on a grand show or anything like that. It was to confirm that the one who was speaking was indeed speaking on God's behalf. But the false teachers are spoken of, for example, in 2 Thessalonians 2:9-10. Their wonders are lying wonders, and they use unrighteous deception to deceive people. And that certainly describes Benny Hinn and his crowd. We already noted earlier when Jesus warned of false prophets in verses 4 and 5 that there is a documented occasion by Josephus when about 6,000 people gathered in the temple complex as this great tragedy was unfolding, and they were locked in a room and set on fire by the Romans, and all of them perished. But they perished because they listened to a false teacher. Does anyone here know David Mead? Well, he predicted that the world was going to end on April 23rd of this year. And I believe it's April 29th today. You would think that people would have a little more common sense. He predicted the world would end two other times, on September 23rd of last year and October 15th of last year. I wonder if he's going to make another prediction anytime soon. He reminds me of Deuteronomy 18, verses 21 and 22. The text reads, "And if you say in your heart, how shall we know the word which the Lord has not spoken?" People like David Mead. "When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not happen or come to pass, that is the thing that the Lord has not spoken." Very simple, isn't it? I got to looking about how many predictions there's been about the end of the world over the years. And according to Wikipedia, at least, there are at least 177 times that can be documented that man has predicted the end of the world. And of course, it's not come true yet. It's going to come true someday. I heard one time that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. You think these folks would learn their error. Well, deceivers take advantage of ignorance and desperation, and that's what we're going to be doing at the time that Jesus is speaking of. He says, beware of false prophets. They would come to you how? In sheep's clothing. They're deceivers. Don't be deceived. And we need to take heed to that and learn from that example. We need to study our Bibles to make sure that we know God's word, so that when someone preaches false teaching to us, we can recognize it, avoid it, and expose it. Well, Christ's coming in judgment against Jerusalem is now described with figurative language by Christ. He says, "For as lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together." His coming in judgment against Jerusalem would be as unmistakable as a bolt of lightning. As one commentator said, "Christ's coming in judgment on Israel would not be done in secret. It would not be done in a corner. it would be as unmistakable and obvious as a bolt of lightning. The Roman armies here are described as a bird eating a dead carcass. On our way in this evening, we passed on the road there. Fortunately, it wasn't where the accident was this morning, but a bunch of vultures circling. So you know what was down on the ground there somewhere. There was a carcass. And actually, when you look at Matthew 24:28, the word there that is translated eagles in the King James and New King James could very well, it's more of a general term, and very well might be referring to vultures, and that's what it's translated in some other versions. So the Roman armies would be like a vulture picking over the dead carcass of Israel. Again, from a good commentator, he says, through the instrumentality of the Roman army, Christ's judgment on Jerusalem would be analogous to a bird of prey falling on a carcass, a figure frequently used by the prophets to describe God's judgments upon a nation. For example, in Isaiah 46 and verse 11, Isaiah prophesies that God would call a bird of prey from the east against Israel. And of course, in 722, the Assyrians overran and took off the northern 10 tribes into captivity. Furthermore, the Romans defiled the temple. According to Josephus, after they had burned the temple, they set up their standards where the temple was located and on the eastern gate and offered sacrifices to their gods, little g. And of course, their standard had on it an eagle. Well, let's continue on into the next verse, verse 29. Jesus now describes judgment using apocalyptic language. He says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. I think this verse probably is one of the primary verses that people misinterpret. They think that Jesus is describing the final judgment and the end of the universe, but he's using what's called apocalyptic language, which was very typical in the Old Testament prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and so forth. It's figurative language, highly figurative, very vivid, and it's used very often to describe judgments against nations, the destruction of nations. Again, the culmination of the tribulation would be the fall of Jerusalem and the political religious complex it represented. The language, insofar as the darkened sun and the moon and the falling stars, so forth, is apocalyptic. Celestial phenomena were often used by the prophets to describe God's historical judgments on cities and nations. And we could cite a whole slew of them. And I'll cite just two. In Isaiah 13 and 10, this is a description of the destruction of Babylon. God says, for the stars of the heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. So when this nation is overthrown, they cease to exist. As far as Babylon was concerned, after their destruction, there was no moon, there was no sun or stars. In Ezekiel 32 and verse 7, talks about the judgment against Egypt. He says, when I put out your light, I will cover the heavens and make its stars dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. All the bright lights of the heavens I will make dark over you and bring darkness upon your land, says the Lord God. So Jesus is using the very same terminology to describe the fate of Israel and the destruction of their wonderful city. Jerusalem and the nation must fall as stars, tumbling from their perch in the heavens, one writes. Another writes, the grim fate of the temple and city that many assume to be inviolable as the sanctuary in which God dwells and the city of the great king was far more momentous than the divine judgment of Babylon and Egypt, and at least worthy of the same rhetorical fireworks, the same kind of language. When the Jews heard this kind of language, they instantly knew what the speaker was talking about. We sometimes use similar figurative language. For example, in a boxing match, what does one boxer sometimes do to another? He knocks his lights out. Well, he doesn't literally knock his lights out, but he knocks him down onto the canvas. So this, again, is speaking of the destruction of Jerusalem and not Jesus' second coming to judge all mankind. Well, the Jewish nation ended in 70 AD, just as Jesus predicted in 23 and verse 38. Your house is left unto you desolate. The sun, as far as the Jewish nation was concerned, would no longer shine on it because it ceased to exist. It was overthrown. The moon would no longer give light to the Jewish nation. It was no more. Now, the stars, perhaps, is referring to the important people of the Jewish nation. What was going to happen to them? They were going to be either dead or taken captive by the Romans. One writes, "The sun shall be darkened and the moon shall not give her light," is nearly a verbatim quote from the words of Isaiah, who spoke of the burden of Babylon in the prophetic announcement that God would stir up the Medes against them. "Shall be shaken" is an image of convulsions in the solar system that portrays the trembling of the ruling powers who were removed from their positions of authority by the wrath of God, a vengeance that thwarts the satanic power by which they afflict God's people. The downfall of nations is attributed to their wickedness and to their refusal to serve God and exalt righteousness. Remember Proverbs 4 and verse 34. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Though God may use a nation to punish his own people, as he did with Assyria and Babylon, he does so because they are already wicked, and it is in their hearts to do that. He's guiding events through his providence. They themselves, when the siege ends, are guilty because of their evil deeds and must suffer the same wrath that they administered to others. Assyria conquered the northern 10 tribes. And what happened to the nation of Assyria? Well, they were undone by Babylon. Babylon took off the southern 2 tribes into captivity. And what happened to them? Well, they were overthrown by the Medes. Another writes, Jesus, in declaring the doom of Jerusalem, announced in the words of Isaiah, "To Babylon, the end of the glory and beauty of Israel. God's elect nation, which had been exalted above all nations, but now because of her unfaithfulness, must fall." Jesus now talks about the sign of the Son of Man in verse 30. He says, "Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." This signifies Christ's presence in judgment on Jerusalem. Again, apocalyptic language. It's not literal. One writes this, "The phrase, the sign of the Son of Man, implies Christ's presence in the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Now, very importantly, though not present bodily, he was present through the instrument of the Roman army. God used Assyria and Babylon in ancient times. Clouds are often associated with God's presence, and he cites a number of passages, and we'll read some in a moment. "And the power and great glory indicate the majestic appearance of a king. In this context, however, the king's coming is greeted with mourning. All the tribes of the earth will mourn." Isaiah 19 and verse 1, "Behold, the Lord rides on a swift cloud as he comes against Egypt." Ezekiel 30, verses 3 and 4. The prophet writes that the day is near, even the day of the Lord is near. It will be day of clouds, the time of the Gentiles. The sword shall come upon Egypt, and great anguish shall be in Ethiopia when the slain fall in Egypt, and they take away her wealth, and her foundations are broken down. Similar language is used in John's Revelation, Revelation 14 and verse 14. "Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and on the cloud sat one like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. So the cloud, the idea of clouds, is the idea of divine judgment overshadowing a nation. Let's turn over to Psalm chapter 2. A very messianic psalm. In Psalm 2, let's read the whole psalm. I think it fits in very well with verse 30. The psalmist writes, "Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his Christ, saying, Let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Then he shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, You are my son, and today I have begotten thee. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession." Now notice, verse 9, "You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel." Christ has done that to many nations, and now it's Israel's turn to have that rod of iron against them. "Now therefore be wise, O kings, be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling." That's the way to avoid that punishment as a nation. "Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are those who put their trust in him." Jesus also mentions that all the tribes of the earth would mourn. Well, I think this has to be limited to the tribes of Israel, because when Jerusalem was destroyed, many of the other people of the world rejoiced. They hated the Jews like many hate them today, unfortunately. So the fact that the tribes of earth would be limited to the Jews, I believe, is a very important reason to limit this to the destruction of Jerusalem and not to the end of the world. Next, as we move on to verse 31, Christ gathers his elect. Somebody else wrote it, "And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." I believe that this is signifying the preaching of the gospel that was done in the first century by the apostles and prophets, and not the gathering of the elect on the final day of judgment. In Mark 16, and verse 15, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." And that's exactly what is being expressed there in verse 31. One writes that God's elect are no longer the members of one nation, but a people drawn from all the corners of the earth. Angels likely refers to gospel preachers whose work would have had the effect of a trumpet blast calling men to salvation. Christ's work was not primarily destructive, even though the wicked must be judged, but redemptive. So here men are being gathered for salvation from all over the earth. At the final judgment, there's going to be a gathering, but it's going to be a gathering of the tares that have been sown, for example, in Matthew chapter 13 and verse 41, and they will be gathered out of the kingdom, but this is gathered into the kingdom through the preaching of the gospel. Well, now Jesus turns very importantly to the timing of these events. In Matthew 24 and verse 32, "Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branches have already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see these things, know that near at the doors." Jesus has answered the what part of the question. If you remember several lessons back, we talked about the what, when, and the where. Now he's going to address the when of those questions. And he uses a very familiar illustration. Might be like in Indiana. When you see the red bud blossoming, you know that spring's here, right? And in that country. When you see the fig tree putting forth leaves, then you know that summer is near. So when these visible signs that he has already enumerated present themselves, the destruction of Jerusalem, he says, is at the door. It's like someone coming to your front door and knocking. It's there. There's no question. Especially in our house, when you ring the doorbell, the dogs go crazy. So you know somebody's at the door. So this coming of Christ is predictable, unlike his second and final coming on the day of judgment. Well, in verse 34 is the most important timing clue in the entire chapter. Jesus says, "Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place." So again, a very important time stamp here. Any interpretation of Matthew 24 the verses we've already talked about, must consider that these events would transpire while that current generation, at least some of them, were still alive. So if it didn't happen in that generation, we're in a conundrum. He either was wrong, or we've got some people walking around that are over 2,000 years old. And of course, we know that's not the case. One writes this. He says, "When identified specifically, this generation refers to the sum total of those born at the same time, expanded to include all those living at a given time. Generation, contemporaries. The word also refers to the age of the period of time in which a generation lives." We talk about the greatest generation, those that fought in World War II and so forth. This generation that Jesus is speaking to would still be around when these events took place. So any dispensationalist or premillennial view that attributes these verses to some yet future time, they cannot be right. It just cannot be. Now Christ stamps his authority on what's been said, and I believe he opens a new line of discussion where he talks about the final, the destruction of the universe. He says, very importantly, heaven and earth will pass away. There's going to be the second coming as we know it, for example, from 2 Peter chapter 3. Heaven and earth will pass away. But of that day and hour, what day and hour? The day and hour that heaven and earth passes away. No one knows, not even the angels in heaven, but my Father only. Jesus is using what's called idiomatic language. He's telling us God's word is eternal, permanent, it's unchangeable. We use idioms all the time. We talk about somebody that's got a chip on their shoulder. Well, they don't have a literal chip on their shoulder. They have an attitude problem. Jesus is using the words of verse 35 to drive home the certainty of the destruction of Jerusalem. But I think he introduces another subject. Now, I wouldn't be highly dogmatic about this if somebody quibbled about it. I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference. But I think there are several key indicators here that the subject has changed. Okay, again, I believe verse 35 marks a key transitional point when he turns the discussion from the destruction of Jerusalem to the end of the world, the consummation of the universe. And I'm going to give you a few reasons. First of all, the timing of the event Jesus describes in verse 36 is unknown. But the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, I will admit, you couldn't necessarily predict the very day that it would happen, but you could predict the time in which it would happen with relative precision. With enough precision that if you knew Jesus' discourse here in Matthew 24, you could flee Jerusalem and avoid this destruction. It's an easily discernible event. When you see all these things, you know it's near, at the door. Jesus, very importantly, refers to the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew 24, in verse 22 and 29, as those days. Now notice, the time when the heaven and earth will pass away is described as that day and hour that no one knows, versus those days. To me, that's an important indicator that the subject has changed. Jesus had intimate knowledge of the timing of the destruction of Jerusalem. He told the disciples these signs. But of the day and the hour when the heavens and earth will pass away, not even he knows that, or the angels know it, only the Father in heaven. One put it this way. He says, that day and hour are spoken in contrast to the days, or those days. When earlier Jesus spoke of the times of attack, the siege, and the days of affliction and tribulation at Jerusalem, Jesus apparently spoke of a day and hour beyond the time when the destruction of Jerusalem was complete and the wrath of God had been accomplished against them and the end of the nation had been finalized. Jesus now speaks of that day and that hour in an apparent switch to the times when the heavens and earth shall pass away. Again, a time known only to the Father. No man knows. The angels which are in heaven are not privy to this information. Even the Son has no knowledge of it. The time is kept secret in the mind of God so that the Son, who is one with the Father and is equal to him, has chosen to close his mind to that time, the time of that day and hour. I'm going to give some more reasons here in a moment as we look at some other verses. Now Jesus, I believe, describes the conditions that will on the earth when heaven and earth pass away, that day and hour of the final judgment. He says, but as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Then two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and the other left. Certainly the nation of Israel was arrogant. They thought they were bulletproof against the Romans. But they knew this was coming to some extent because this war lasted for 4 years. The destruction of Jerusalem came at the end of the war. For over 3 years, the Romans had been ravaging the countryside in Judea. So that, to me, doesn't fit with the days of Noah. Jesus uses cameos here of everyday life to illustrate preparedness. So regardless of your view of whether he's continuing the discussion of the destruction of Jerusalem or he's talking about the final judgment, it doesn't matter. We need to be prepared for the Lord's coming whenever he comes. One writes this, and it's worthy of remembering. The deciding factor in whether one is spared or lost will be one's readiness to obey Christ's directions. Another writes, the unpreparedness of Noah's contemporaries would be paralleled by a lack of readiness. In Noah's day, it was business as usual, wasn't it? Everything was just hunky-dory. Life was sweet, and people just were carrying on with their everyday lives. And that's the way it's going to be at the final day of judgment. It's going to come thief in the night, unexpected. These verses indicate that in the event described, and this is another important reason why I think he's talking about the final judgment, this event, one will be taken and the other left. But when you think about the signs of the destruction of Jerusalem, they were very clear, weren't they? And if you heeded it, there was no need for you to be left behind and not taken. You could have seen this coming. Well, Christ warns his disciples to be watchful. In Matthew 24, verses 42 to 44, watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." So again, regardless of what position one takes, Jesus unequivocally calls for his disciples to be ready, to be watchful. The practical lesson is that men need to be watchful. Watchfulness, as defined by Christ, and this is very important, is not excited expectation, but faithfulness to one's responsibilities. So Jesus uses the example of a thief. What about thieves? Thieves don't make appointments, do they? They come when we least expect it. And that's the way God's final day of judgment will be. It's a secret, again, only known by him. So we all always must be prepared. As verse 44 said, "Therefore also be ready, because he's coming in an hour that we do not expect it." Well, we're going to bring our lesson to a close here very shortly, but in the next verses, which Lord willing we'll get to next week, this idea of readiness is expressed by three parables. The parable of the faithful and evil servant, the parable of the wise and foolish virgins, and the parable of the talents. And that will take us well into chapter 25. Then, very obviously, in chapter 25, verses 31 to 46, he's talking about the final judgment when all the nations will be gathered before him. Well, I hope that lesson has helped you get a better understanding of Matthew 24. And most importantly, an understanding that we need to be watchful and we need to be ready. The Lord's coming at a day and an hour that we don't know. He could come before this service ends. He could come sometime next week, or it could be 1,000 years from now. We just don't know. So we have to be ready. Because when he comes, all the nations, all the people that ever lived will be gathered together, and the Lord will judge them. He'll judge me and you on what we have done as an individual. And we're going to hear one of two things said to us by the Lord. "I never knew you. Depart from me," which we don't want to hear. Or he's going to say, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of thy Lord." Those are the words I want to hear. And I hope that all of us that are here hear the same words. If you're not ready, you need to become ready. The Bible very clearly teaches that we must believe that God is, that is, he exists, Hebrews 11, verse 6, and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. If you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, if you're willing to confess that before men and turn away from your sinful life, to be buried with your Lord in baptism, he'll wash away your sins and add you to his church, Acts 2 and verse 47. The church is the body, and Jesus is the Savior of the body. So the church is the group, the ones that are going to be saved. If you want to become part of that, we invite you to come while we stand and sing.
Why keep Jesus waiting?